This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
I'm Wong Xiaoning, and this is The Breakfast Grill. 2019 will be remembered as a year dominated by headlines of the trade war between the US and China against a backdrop of slowing global growth. But are we out of the woods yet, especially for ASEAN? And how should we maneuver in this new world order? To answer that question and more, we have on our panel today Dr. Jayan Menon, lead economist at the Asian Development Bank, who is joining us on the phone from Manila, and Dr. Donald Hanna, chief economist at CIMB, who is in the studio with me. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. A lot to discuss, but let's tackle the big elephant in the room first, the US-China trade war. Now, Jayan, phase one of a trade deal was agreed at really what was the last hour before the 15 December deadline. Apparently de-escalating the trade war between the Chinese and Americans. But should we breathe a sigh of relief, or is this trade war going to be an ongoing one?
I think this is a good sign that the end may be near. But the point I'd like to make is that this will probably go on and find new forms of expression down the road. The issue here is that the trade war itself is just shadow play, right? This underlying geopolitical struggle for economic dominance will continue beyond this trade war. And we can't actually expect that the world will return to a civilized, rules-based order just because of this phase one deal. I think it will continue in different ways. This is not really about trade. It's about technology, it's about global dominance. So I think while we should welcome this positive development, it's not the end.
And do you agree, Don? Do you think that this is just the beginning of a new Cold War? I mean, this is something that actually, like Stephen Roach, the former chairman of Morgan Stanley, says, it's going to be an enduring Cold War conflict. And the last Cold War took 45 years to end.
It did. And in that time, you had something called the Iron Curtain. This time, I think we have a bamboo curtain that's being lowered. As Jayan said, this is a question that extends beyond the question beyond trade itself, and is as much a question about politics, how one organizes your countries and the relationships between countries. And we're witnessing the erosion, essentially, of the institutions and framework for resolving international conflict that developed after the Second World War into something that looks much more like what we saw prior to that, a kind of 19th century great powers struggle. And in that sense, the phase one deal on trade is welcome relief, but it's not going to be lasting because the elements of that agreement that aren't there, things like technology, state subsidies, and the like, are fundamental issues that are very unlikely to be resolved. And hence, phase one is probably the first and the last trade-related deal that we will get between China and the United States, certainly in the next year.
John, will the rhetoric ratchet up as Trump heads into elections in next year?
I think with the Trump administration, certainly, they're facing an election and they want to ensure that they don't have a recession in the U.S. His prospects of being reelected will diminish significantly if there's a recession. So I think clearly they want to try and keep growth on track. And this is why they're pushing ahead with this so-called phase one resolution. But I don't see any real positive outlook at the moment. The IMF, in its World Economic Outlook, has downgraded growth from 3.6 to 3.5. I think that's still a bit optimistic. I think growth might slow even further. It's hard to know what's really going on in China. The numbers, of course, can't be believed completely. But reading the tea leaves, it looks like there's a lot more out there in terms of risks on the downside. So I'm not all that optimistic. As Don said, I think this is welcome relief, but there's a lot more negative risks on the downside going forward. But the U.S. administration is very keen to avoid a recession. And I think that's what we can hope for in terms of getting more positive resolution of this trade war. But you know, it's all come a bit late. I mean, the impacts are already biting. The global value chains have already been fractured. There's a lot of restructuring taking place. And this will have long-lasting negative effects.
Don, there's always this question as to who is winning or losing in this fight. Is it China or U.S.?
Look, everybody's a loser in this deal, and it's only a question of who's losing more. If you look at the nature of the deal, all the details aren't out there. But one of the things that strikes me is that what China has agreed to are things that are in its own interest and would be in its own interest regardless of what U.S. policy is. In other words, protection, for example, for intellectual property rights is now more important in China because China has more patents. It's generating its own IP that it wants to protect. It also has a much smaller current account surplus than it used to have. And so attracting foreign direct investment is a much more interesting thing to do when you don't have the domestic savings to fund your growth. And of course, with the food supply issues, yeah, getting more food in more cheaply is also in its interest.
Now, Don, you have written that the Chinese domestic economy will weaken, and we have already started seeing signs of this in their industrial production and consumption data. So does this put pressure on the Chinese to come to the table and agree to terms that they would not otherwise accept in a trade deal? Because on the other hand, the U.S. economy seems to be in very good shape at the moment.
Certainly, the deceleration complicates China's economic management. But the fundamental problem isn't really U.S. trade policy. That's exacerbating a gap that exists between the politically mandated desire to grow at 6% or more, so it's double per capita incomes, against the fact that the potential growth, how fast the supply side in China can actually grow, is a number that's probably somewhere between 5 and 5.5. And so when you're trying to go faster than your supply side can generate, you'll push up inflation or you'll suck in a lot more imports. And that's destabilizing.
Against a backdrop of trying to deleverage.
You end up not deleveraging. So you're creating a sense of financial risk. And it's that fundamental conflict that China has to grapple with. And you can see that in the statements they made after their Central Economic Work Conference just last week, where the growth rate target wasn't announced, but it's sort of around 6%. They're trying to create some wiggle room to grow more slowly, but not so slowly as to miss their target or to generate anxiety or pressures domestically about this deceleration in economic activity.
Optics seem to be that you have some countries align more to China than to the US. And correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, it just appears that, like, for example, Cambodia, Laos, and Thailand are more aligned to China, while from appearances, it looks like Vietnam and Singapore are closer to US. Jayan, do you think this is a fair assessment, or is it more complicated than that?
Chinese have been investing heavily in the Mekong region, and there is a sense of dependency there. But, trade is still an important part of the relationship with the US, right? US is still the final destination for a lot of the exports from this region, right? A lot of the intra-regional trade is in parts and components, but the final demands are still very much in the Western industrialized world. And so they cannot ignore that reality, right? Investment, China is a big investor in the region, and they'll continue to be so. In fact, it'll grow. The final demands is what matters in the end. And so if they start aligning with one or the other, this will be detrimental to their long-term growth. I think the countries realize that, and they won't jeopardize that relationship in the long run. They need to keep trading channels open and recognize the importance of the U.S. market as the final destination market for their produced goods. Investment, yes. Okay, China is very important, but final demands are still very much in the Western industrialized world.
Don?
I think one thing to realize with regard to Chinese investment into the Belt Road Initiative, to BRI, is that with the shrinkage of the Chinese current account from over 10 percentage points of GDP 11 years ago to about 0.5% today, and in some quarters actually negative, the funds available from China to go out, at least on a net basis, are much, much smaller. Yeah. And so the idea that there's going to be this ever flowing tap or gusher
of money
coming from China.
Of checkbook diplomacy.
is going to be constrained, particularly in this environment in which China is continuing to try and grow faster than its supply side will allow. That implies that China net is going to need savings from the rest of the world, not the other way around.
So the BRI initiatives aren't this Trojan horse that people initially feared.
That's a different issue. I'd say that the volume of monies one can expect through that program are going to be constrained by the fact that on net, unless China decelerates more aggressively in terms of growth, that they will not have the resources to supply the rest of the world with savings while also funding their own investment. The rest of the world will need to supply savings to China. And that hasn't happened at any point in the last 30 years of this phenomenal expansion of the Chinese economy.
You've been listening to The Breakfast Grill, where I'm speaking to Dr. Jayan Menon, lead economist at the Asian Development Bank, and Dr. Donald Hannah, chief economist at CIMB. Up next, which country wins in the substitution game, and does this regional intergovernment organization of 10 countries achieve any objectives with its ASEAN way? BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, I'm Wong Xiaoning, and this is the Breakfast Grill, where I'm speaking to Dr. Jayan Menon, lead economist at the ASEAN Development Bank, and Dr. Donald Hannah, chief economist at CIMB. Just a few moments ago, we were talking about the US-China trade war and how ASEAN should align itself in this new Cold War. Now, gentlemen, let's spend some time on the actual impact US-China trade war has on the global supply chain. So with this new world order, I mean, multinational companies are probably hedging their bets, just like countries. But which country benefits? What do you think, Jayan? Or can ASEAN position itself as a single production base to benefit all around then?
I think ASEAN is a production base for the global value chain. There'll be some countries that benefit more than others. At the moment, we've already seen significant growth increases in countries like Vietnam, for instance, but also Thailand and maybe even Malaysia is benefiting from all of this. Other countries that are not that receptive to value chain investments like Philippines and Indonesia might receive a bit more investment going forward. But the main players, Malaysia, Thailand, Vietnam, Singapore as well, are the ones that I think will benefit the most, right? Yeah, and we've already seen that. ASEAN as a whole, I think, will benefit. But some countries will benefit more than others. But the world as a whole will lose from this trade war. There's no doubt about it. And if the value chain fractures, if you have two value chains as a consequence of this trade war, then there's huge welfare costs and social waste. And this will probably happen. It's already happening. But this is probably the reality for the future, unfortunately.
And Don, I want to bring it back home to Malaysia. How can we benefit? Or as what Jayan said, there are really actually no winners, only losers in this game.
As we were talking about a moment ago, I think the way forward with this is to take advantage of the unexploited opportunities of greater association with neighboring countries within the framework of ASEAN.
But aren't we competing with each other in reality? You know, if I want to relocate my manufacturing facilities out of China or kind of diversify, I can't have factories in every ASEAN country, right? I'll have to choose one, if at all, maybe two. It's a competition almost, isn't it?
There's a level of competition, of course, but there's also many different industries. So if you look at the supply chains, Thailand, for example, is more dominant in the auto supply chain that's internationalized. And Malaysia and Singapore have greater dominance in the supply chains associated with technology and electronics. And in Vietnam, you have more of the the consumer-oriented electronics that is a basis of much of what goes on in Vietnam. But there is also opportunities for many other firms. What you want to get out of ASEAN is the extension of the opportunities for not per se multinational companies, but rather for those who currently have a national focus, but they could have a regional focus. And getting those gains, there's still the concept of comparative advantage associated with the levels of education, the levels of infrastructure, the level of different sorts of resources that can be better exploited with a larger market associated with tearing down those barriers across ASEAN, be those barriers that block logistics, barriers that block technology transfer, that block financial flows. All of those things are more imperative to take advantage of in the face of this more conflictual external environment.
So, Jenny,
can I also just add to that?
Yes, please.
So I think what Don was saying is exactly right. I mean, you know, we are in a world of supply chains. In before the 60s or so, we had a very different type of production system. You know, countries pretty much, you know, produce goods from start to end. But now we have the slicing of the value chain. We have this incredible interdependence in production. Right. So while there's competition attract investment, there's so much interdependencies because every country specializes in one part of the value chain, and you need the whole value chain to work together. And ASEAN is characterized by this type of specialization. So. Not a zero-sum game. So, every bit of the value chain takes in different parts of ASEAN, and when one bit grows, the rest also is affected and lifted by this restructuring. So some countries will benefit more than others, but everyone gets part of this benefit because of the interdependence of global value chain.
Now, gentlemen, we spent quite a lot of time talking about ASEAN and how it should respond to this new world order. But at the same time, there are critics that say ASEAN as an economic community is rather ineffective. Do you think that's a fair criticism, Don?
There's always the ideal and what happens in practice. And so while I think the general success of ASEAN, if you look at a world scale, of the countries within ASEAN is among the best that you've got. And so particularly if you think about the initial conditions of many of the countries prior to going back to the 1960s. And so while, yes, there are unfulfilled potential and that's something to be exploited, that's a challenge going forward and not, I don't think, a criticism of what has happened over the past.
What do you think, Jayan? Is it successful as an economic community? Or is there work to be done?
Right, there's always more work to be done. But I think ASEAN's regionalism is different from the European version of it. And we get, kind of embedded in this European model as the only model of regionalism. It's not. I mean, Europe is a huge economic bloc and it can self-sustain, but ASEAN's regionalism is all about globalization, right? So ASEAN's success is not that it's increased intra-regional trade. It hasn't, but that's a good sign. It hasn't diverted trade amongst each other, but it's used regionalism to engage more fully with the rest of the world. So it's not intra-regional trade or investment that matters, but trade and investment. And it's increased both trade and investment overall. And that's what's important. So this is a different approach that ASEAN has taken, quite rightfully, by the way, to regionalism, which is to use it as a means to globalize and engage with the broader global economy rather than just focusing on trying to engage more with each other. They can increase relationships, and they should, especially in services going forward. But I think we should not focus too much on just intra-regional flows. ASEAN has been outward-looking, And there's no fortress ASEAN like in Europe, nor should there be. The ASEAN economic community is slowly coming together, but that's not the important thing. The important thing is that we don't lose focus on international relations. And that's what we have to avoid when the rhetoric starts ratcheting up with all this talk about community. It's an open, outward-looking regionalism, and that needs to be preserved going forward.
But John, the point about ASEAN, you know, and the way that, like what Jayan mentioned, this openness, but that also is conflicted by the fact that the ASEAN way of doing things is very diplomatic, isn't it? It's very non-confrontational. But then does that mean that we, as ASEAN, as a bloc, doesn't say what it's meant to say and doesn't actually get its act together sometimes?
The question of consensual or a consensual process is necessarily going to be a messier one than somebody and then being told what to do.
Okay. Because the challenge is trying to create a single market, right? But if you're non-confrontational and you're always diplomatic, doesn't it then become much harder?
There's a question of what you can agree to and the durability of what you agree to. Yeah. So one of the elements that comes out of a consensual process is when you find the elements of a convergence, that's likely itself to be much more durable than an environment in which somebody is strong-arming you. Because as soon as you have the opportunity, that grip loosened, you'll change. Whereas if you've actually negotiated a process, as messy as that can be, that's much more likely to be durable, firstly. Secondly, Jayant was mentioning the fact that part of what's going on here is an element of openness to the rest of the world. Yeah? Mm-hmm. The challenge that the rest of the world is creating today for ASEAN is that there's increasingly difficult in different parts of the world for ASEAN to be open because there are greater degrees of nationalist protectionist forces.
More barriers,
which is reinforcing the need not just to be open to the rest of the world, but also to be internally more integrated. And that does create these issues of needing to extend the concept of community, of mutual benefit to a broader area in distinction to what's going on in the rest of the world. That is a challenge, a political as well as an economic challenge, and will require redoubling of efforts for that consensual focus to have the idea not just of openness but of integration more firmly inculcated. But of course, it's easier to integrate in the face of an external threat than in the absence of that threat.
So this is actually, ironically, an opportunity for ASEAN to work together.
I think so, yes.
On that note, thank you for your time today, Don and Jayan, for this very interesting discussion on ASEAN and how it should navigate these challenging economic times. I'm Wong Xiaoning for The Morning Run, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.